The House manager's brief in the Senate basically says that they have a roving commission to go after any former office holder, maybe even anybody who could be a future office holder, and impeach them even though they can't remove them. I'll explain why the House manager's brief is just dead wrong. We'll also talk about the president being compelled now to testify, the former president being compelled to testify in front of the Senate impeachment trial, why that too would not be proper. You'll hear that all on The Dirt Show. The House managers filed their brief recently in an effort to try to get the Senate to remove former President Trump. Yesterday on The Dirt Show, I went over the part of the brief that dealt with the First Amendment and came to the conclusion that the brief itself was more dangerous to our liberties than anything that former President Trump was accused of doing. What President Trump was accused of doing was very serious, and I think the violence in the Capitol was horrendous. But it's gone. It's passed. It's over. We survived. For us to compromise the First Amendment permanently by following what was said in the House manager's brief, namely that the First Amendment doesn't apply at all to impeachment proceedings, even though the First Amendment governs everything that Congress does, would pose enormous dangers of compromising our liberty under the First Amendment and ultimately other amendments to the Constitution. What other amendments might not apply to impeachment? Congress is not above the law, and it's not above the Constitution. And today, I'm going to review the second part of the brief that was filed by the House managers, claiming that there's absolutely no doubt, it would be unthinkable to doubt, that Senate has jurisdiction over a former president. Here's what the brief says. It says there's no statute of limitations. Impeachment can go forward whenever the abuse of power may have occurred or been discovered. There is no statute of limitations, no restrictions based on whether a person is still in office. According to this view, the House and the Senate have a roving commission to look into the conduct of every former official who has ever served in government and to impeach them and prevent them from running for office again. Where do they get that? They certainly don't get it from the text of the Constitution. The text of the Constitution says the president, vice president, and all civil officers shall be removed from office on impeachment and conviction of treason, bribery, etc. So there are two things there. Number one, civil officers. That means people who are now serving, not former civil officers, and shall be removed. That surely suggests that the Senate's power is limited to sitting civil officers. But the brief then points to another provision of the Constitution that says judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and not or, and disqualification to hold and employ any office, etc. They read that as giving the Senate an independent power. They don't have to remove. All they have to do is disqualify. In other words, under their reading of the Constitution, let's assume President Trump was impeached, as he was, a year ago. I was one of his lawyers. I defended the Constitution in front of the Senate. Let's assume that the Senate decided we don't want to remove him from office. We just don't want him to run for re-election. And so we're going to impeach him, but not remove him, just disqualify him. According to the brief of the House managers, that would have been proper. Nothing could be further from the mind of the framers. And if you don't believe me, listen to James Madison. James Madison was the father of the Constitution. And here's what he said in Federalist Number 39. The President of the United States is impeachable. Now listen to the words, Madison's words, not mine. Impeachable at any time during his continuance in office. During his continuance in office. Here's the father of the Constitution answering the question that the Senate has posed. Can you impeach and remove a president once he's left office? Madison says no, he can be impeached any time during his continuance in office. So where do the House managers get this? Where do they get the authority to say it's not even a close question? If they said it was a close question, all right, you can debate it. I think it's a question that is easily resolved against jurisdiction. Say it's a close. They don't say it's a close question. Unthinkable. No doubt. Absolute. You know, that's a bad brief. That loses credibility with the reader because we know it's not absolutely certain. The words of the Constitution itself point the other way. The father of the Constitution's own words point the other way. So it's certainly not clear. It's certainly not obvious. It's certainly not unthinkable to take the opposing point of view. And so ultimately, here's what the House and managers say. Well, of course, it's without a doubt, because a lot of law professors have signed a petition. A lot of law professors have signed a petition saying that you can impeach a former president. Yeah, and the same law professors, not all of them, but a great many of them, would have signed exactly the opposite petition if Hillary Clinton had been impeached, or if Bill Clinton was impeached, or after they left office. We may see that. We may see what happens if Hillary Clinton were to be impeached by the Republican House of Representatives in 2024, if in fact there is 2022, rather, if there is a new Republican House majority. No, the law professors were using their professorship as an imprimatur for ideological positions that they reached independently because of their hatred for Donald Trump, their opposition to Donald Trump. Look, I too was opposed to what Donald Trump said in the Capitol on that day. I thought it was a terrible speech, and I did think that he bore some moral responsibility for what happened thereafter. That doesn't make it an impeachable offense, and it doesn't mean the Senate has jurisdiction. I stick to my principles, no matter what I think of the person, what I think of the party. But many law professors just go with their ideology, with their biases, with their partisan preferences, and then search for constitutional bases to justify what they've already concluded. But I don't think you can find a constitutional basis for this, certainly not in the text of the Constitution, certainly not in the words of James Madison. So then they go to precedent, and they say, in Britain, you can impeach a former office holder. We fought a revolution against Britain. We rejected the British approach to impeachment. Remember, in Britain, you don't impeach kings or prime ministers. You only impeach relatively low-level officials. And during the Constitutional Convention, there were efforts to try to emulate the British approach. Somebody introduced a resolution to allow impeachment on the ground of maladministration, which was the English term. That was the English criteria, maladministration. If you were an ambassador somewhere in India and you messed up and you maladministered, you could be impeached, as one of them was at the time of the Constitutional Convention. But Madison said, no, we don't want the British approach, because that will allow Congress to oversee the presidency and have the president serve at the pleasure of Congress, which is the English system. In the English system, a prime minister serves at the pleasure of the parliament. As soon as the parliament snaps his finger and says no vote of confidence, they're out. We rejected that approach. So the idea of citing the English precedent cuts exactly the other way. And then they cite another precedent. Yes, we did have one case where a cabinet member was impeached after he left office. What happened is he was going to be impeached. They caught him with his fingers in the cookie jar. He was taking kickbacks and bribes. He confessed his guilt to President Grant, cried, and immediately offered his resignation, which Grant accepted, knowing he'd be impeached and removed if he didn't resign. And so they did impeach him. And they did vote. And the brief, of course, emphasizes that they voted in favor of the Senate having jurisdiction by a close vote. I think it was 35 to 29, something like that. And then they had a trial. But what the brief leaves out is the result of the trial. The result of the trial was he was acquitted on the ground that the Senate didn't have jurisdiction. 23 or 24, I don't remember, senators who thought he was guilty. Everybody thought he was guilty. He was caught with his, you know, his fingers in the jar. But 23, 24, whatever the number were, senators didn't think he was innocent. They voted to acquit on the ground that the Senate didn't have jurisdiction. So what's the precedent there? The precedent is the brief of the managers doesn't cite a single case because there is none. a single case in American history where a former official was in fact removed and disqualified, not removed because he's already a former official. So a former official was disqualified based on an impeachment. They can't cite a case because there is none. There is no case, as far as I know and as far as the brief writers know, where a former official has been impeached and disqualified, just disqualified, from running for future office. So they're trying to break new ground. They're trying to arrogate to the House and Senate a power that was never, ever before employed, the power to disqualify a future candidate for office on the ground that he committed an impeachable offense while he was in office 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Doesn't matter, because the House manager said there's no statute of limitations. It absolutely doesn't matter whether and when it occurred. So if Hillary Clinton were to announce that she's going to run, they could now go and impeach her. Or if somebody were to announce on the Republican Party that he or she is going to run for president in 2024, the Democratic-controlled House can impeach that person if that person ever served in office in the United States. You wonder why they limit it to people who have served in office. Under their logic, you could take any citizen who's 35 years old and born in the United States who could conceivably run for office and impeach that person, because if the impeachment power independently, without removal, independently allows disqualification for future office, then it applies to everybody. And that just cannot be what the framers of the Constitution intended. It is certainly not what James Madison intended. And so, again, I urge people, don't read the New York Times assessment of the brief. Read the brief itself. It's online. Read it and shudder, because you will see how far it goes. There are no real limiting principles in this brief. And what it does is it places Congress above the law. President's not above the law, but neither is Congress. They too take an oath to the Constitution. And this brief essentially violates that oath because it seeks to grant the Senate a power that the framers of the Constitution never intended it to have. So I want to hear your views on this. I want to mention just one more subject relating to the trial in the Senate that just came across the wires, literally minutes before I started to do this show. Apparently, the House managers, maybe the Senate too, I don't know, are demanding that President Trump testify at the disqualification trial. And they imply that if he doesn't testify, they can draw a negative inference, an inference of guilt from his refusal to testify. No. You can't do that. You can only draw an inference of guilt if somebody pleads the privilege against self-incrimination, the Fifth Amendment. They say, I refuse to answer on the ground that my truthful answer might tend to incriminate you. Me, the courts have said you can draw a negative inference that his answer would in fact have incriminated him. But if the president were to go to court where he lives in Florida, or where the Senate lives in the District of Columbia, and say, look, I don't have to submit to that subpoena because the Senate has no jurisdiction over me. This is an improper trial, and you have to rule before you can make me submit to testimony to a subpoena. You have to rule that the Senate has authority. Not only that, you have to rule that I don't have any privileges. He can invoke privileges other than the privilege against self-incrimination. He can invoke executive privilege. We know executive privilege applies even after a president's left office. You can't subpoena a former president and ask him, tell us the deep, dark secrets of why you made this policy or that policy. There's executive privilege. And there are other privileges as well that might apply. And you can't infer guilt from the invocation of a legitimate constitutional privilege. They tried to do that in the first impeachment, which I defended against. They said that obstruction of Congress is a high crime and misdemeanor, even though all the president did in those days was to resist congressional efforts based on his view that they were unconstitutional. And that view was validated by a number of courts. And of course, that article of impeachment was defeated by a vote of the Senate. So you know, if you're a lawyer or if you're interested in the Constitution or if you're just an ordinary average citizen who cares deeply about our country, this is a interesting week coming up for American civics. Even if you got a B in civics in high school, you can get an A-plus now by listening with a critical ear and viewing with a critical eye and understanding with a critical mind what's going on. Do not listen to petitions by law professors. That's the first rule. Do not do that, because you have to look back and see what they said previously and whether it's consistent with what they've said today. That's number one. Number two, decide for yourself. Read the text of the Constitution. It's written in fairly simple terms. And if you read the text as it was written, it seems to strongly suggest that what the House managers are doing is unconstitutional. And when James Madison's on your side in interpreting the Constitution, you have a winning argument, but not according to the House managers. They think they have a winning argument. Let's see what the Senate does. You know, this is going to be a largely partisan vote. There'll be some Republicans, and they may be voting on partisan principles as well. After all, they may want to be the ones to run for president in 2024, and disqualifying President Trump may help them. So just because a few Republicans may join the Democrats doesn't mean it's not a partisan vote. Remember what Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist 65, the greatest danger, not the second greatest danger, the greatest danger lies in impeachment and removal being based on who has the most votes, based on partisan interests and considerations. And we're seeing that. And I have to tell you, if the Senate persists in believing that it has the right to try ordinary citizens, former office holders, we have seen a new development, and a very dangerous development. It means that several hundred members of Congress can decide who you, the American public, all 200 million of you who vote, whether you can vote for a particular candidate. That's not the job of the Senate. That's not the job of the House. That's the job of primaries, conventions, and ultimately the election. So the most fundamental denial of democracy would lie in a Senate decision to disqualify from future office holding a former office holder who can no longer be removed from office. That's at least my view, and that's a view that I think will be presented to the Senate by the president's lawyers. I'm not one of them. I'm here to defend the Constitution. And I hope that that view will prevail in the minds of enough senators to prevent this unconstitutional impeachment and removal from going forward. That's my view on the Dirt Show. Let's hear your views. We're going to talk about impeachment and removal for the next few days. So keep calling. I want to hear what you have to say. Let's begin with our first call for today.
My name's Jim. Mr. Dershowitz, I really enjoy your show. Your openness and open-mindedness and your expertise and your teaching approach make it excellent listening. I'm so thankful you're there. It seems to me that in the future, Congress will review the impeachments of Donald Trump and see that they need to be corrected. Aside from a constitutional amendment, what resources would be available to those Congresses to fix it? Can they rescind an impeachment? Thank you very much.
I don't know the answer to that question, whether you can rescind an impeachment. Look, Congress claims they can do anything. They're above the law. They can impeach somebody who never served in any office. They can remove, they can disqualify. They just have a roving commission. So I don't know what the answer is. No, the Constitution is not going to be amended. The rules of the Senate, the rules of the House could be changed. That's unlikely to happen. I think what we're going to see is the weaponization of impeachment and removal as a political tool to try to gain partisan advantage by whoever controls the House and the Senate. And that's exactly what Hamilton said was the most dangerous result.
Yeah, hi, this is Aaron from Ohio, and I just have a quick question. Clearly, there's two sides as to whether or not this impeachment is constitutional, but shouldn't this be resolved in a court before the Senate is allowed to go ahead with their trial? And if it's not ruled on by a court and they do get the votes to impeach Trump, can Trump appeal it to a court on the grounds that the impeachment was unconstitutional? In other words, that the Senate acted unconstitutionally and then he shouldn't have to face whatever the punishment of the impeachment is. Thank you.
It's a great question. And again, we don't have a definite answer. I think that Donald Trump, Mr. Trump, Citizen Trump, can now go to court and challenge the subpoena, if they give him a subpoena, and say they have no authority to issue a subpoena because they have no authority to put him on trial. He could make that argument. Don't know whether the courts would consider it or not. And if he were to be impeached, convicted, and disqualified, he could take that to court, or he could simply ignore it and say, look, the Senate had no authority. I'm going to run. And if they want to stop me from running, they can bring a lawsuit to stop me from running. So this is uncharted territory. Stay tuned.
Hey, there, Professor Dershowitz. I'm John O'Brien. I'm from Bayridge, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. Why do we even have the justice system if they can't get involved if any of this issues that's going on? First, they didn't want to get involved in the election fraud and all that. And now they don't want to be involved with this fake impeachment. Why we even have them at our justice system? Why are we even paying them? Why? You know, it seems like they don't want to do their jobs. This is what they took the job for. Thank you very much, buddy. Bye.
Thanks. It's always great for me to hear from somebody from Bay Ridge, the adjoining neighborhood of Borough Park where I grew up. The accent reminds me of how I spoke when I was a kid back in Brooklyn. When I go to Brooklyn, I still go back to my wonderful Brooklyn accent, which I love. So the justices have the power to decide what cases they want to hear. They surprised many people when they took the case of Bush versus Gore back in 2000, and they surprised a lot of people when they didn't take the Texas case in 2020. They pick and choose which cases they take. They have discretion, at least in some areas. In some cases, the statute mandates they take the case. Those are very rare. And so the court, by its inaction, often does more important things than by its very action. But, you know, they work hard. They get paid. They do their work. We can disagree with them, but that's part of their job.
I recently discovered your podcast and thoroughly enjoy listening to your fair and balanced analysis. My question is this. Is there anything in the Constitution that requires Congress, both the House and the Senate, to conduct business solely within the confines of the Capitol building or within the boundaries of the District of Columbia? If not, is there anything in the Constitution that would prohibit Congress from conducting business from time to time in other locations throughout the United States? I've been noodling on an idea that Congress should say, let once a quarter meet for a week or two in another major city or state capital in other parts of the U.S., perhaps rotating each quarter to a new location. I think this could really help break up the beltway mentality that exists with our federal politicians and bureaucracy and lobbyists. Thanks for your time.
What an interesting idea. I'd never thought about that. The Constitution does require the construction of a capital, and we remember from the musical Hamilton how that happened. It was in the room and the trade-off that the capital would be essentially in the South with land allocated from Virginia and Maryland in exchange for the state debts being paid. You remember it from Hamilton. But it's in the Constitution. But it doesn't say that it has to be conducted in the Capitol building. The Capitol building wasn't completed until well after the Constitution. My recollection is that early on, maybe Congress did meet in New York and Philadelphia once or twice. I'm not sure it happened after the Constitution was enacted. Historians will have to look that up. I don't see that there'd be anything that would prevent the people from sitting. Look, the Supreme Court could also sit in different places. I remember arguing a double capital case in Arizona. I expected to argue it in front of the Supreme Court of Arizona in the Supreme Court building, and instead the argument was held in the auditorium of a law school because they wanted the law students to hear me argue and the judges decide a very important capital case, and they saw that as part of an educational process. I actually like that. I thought I'd get a better shot at winning and more attention paid to my argument if there were hundreds of law students listening than if they could just kind of dismiss my arguments out of hand. Well, we lost that case, but we eventually won it a couple of years later, and I saved the lives of the two boys who were then on death row. So, yeah, interesting idea. I hadn't thought much about it, and I'm going to start thinking about it now. I love when I get new ideas from my callers, so keep them coming.
Hello, my name is Paul. I think there's credible evidence that Joe Biden sold his influence to China with the help of his son Hunter while he was vice president of the United States. I understand there is an official investigation of this matter. If it turns out that it can be proven that Biden did this, I was wondering, do you think he could be impeached since this happened before he took office? I would like you to weigh in on this. Do you think there is credible evidence that Joe Biden might be guilty of such a crime? And if he is, can he be impeached? Thank you.
It's a great question. I believe in the presumption of innocence. I haven't seen any evidence that would shift the presumption in my mind. I've known Joe Biden for 40 years. I think he's an honorable guy. I do not know his son, Hunter. According to the House managers and the majority in the Senate, Joe Biden could be impeached for what he did as vice president, even though he's no longer vice president. And there was a hiatus of years between the time he was vice president and the time he became president. But according to the House managers, that doesn't matter. There's no statute of limitations. Prediction, he's not going to be impeached, and there's not going to be evidence that turns up of any impeachable offenses or indictable offenses. That may be only my wishful thinking, but that's what I think is going to happen. What great calls. I learned a lot. Issues that I had never thought of. Wow. You know, I'm 82 years old. I thought I had thought of everything. No. You guys think of things I don't think of. Young minds educating the old. So please keep the calls coming on The Dirt Show. An important part of The Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24-7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24-7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.